Today is November 2nd, 2011. This is Joey Beauchamp at the University of Texas at Austin, H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports, Institute for Olympic Studies. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I am interviewing Alfred Jones over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. All right, so let's start with, I guess, your early childhood, where you were born, kind of where you grew up, and how you got involved in athletics and your sport of boxing.
I'll follow the script as it's printed then.
All right, that sounds great.
All right. I was born in Greece, Mississippi, and I was probably one of the last persons born in that particular area. I was raised in Detroit. We came to Detroit when I was approximately 3 years old. I was raised in a large family. There was 10 of us. I had 9 sisters. I was the only male.
Wow.
How did I first get involved with boxing? In 1960, I was 14 years old, and I happened to be watching one evening the U.S. Olympic team boxing in Rome, and I watched Cassius Clay box, and I was just overwhelmed by his skills and his abilities, and I said to myself, that's something I want to do. So as I was going to school, there was a recreation center. They had a boxer there who was training kids, and his name was Eli Leggett. And Eli Leggett was a former professional boxer. He had 2 brothers, T-Li and C-Li Leggett. And I guess he was in his late 30s or early 40s. He was a lightweight, and he was very good at one time. So he began training me when I was 14 years old, and I began running around the block constantly every night after I get home from school, and I would go to the gym, and I constantly trained. I was there 5 nights a week. Eli would come in maybe 3 nights a week, maybe 2 nights a week, but I would be there by myself, and the center manager, Mr. Brockman, I remember him well, used to let me into the boxing room, and I'd be in there by myself, hitting a punching bag and jumping rope and those types of things. And so in 1961, I won the Parks and Recreation Junior Championships as a 14-year-older, and I was just so excited and winning the trophy and watching people watch me. It was a great event for me. And I got a chance to, during that particular summer of 15-year-older, I had a chance to box at a number of centers around the city of Detroit, which is known for the Brewster Recreation Center, where Joe Louis boxed at, and the Motor City Gym, and several other centers. Well, I made my center famous, Weigel Recreation Center, by winning several championships throughout the city. So it was a great experience for me. Then I went to high school. In high school, because I did a lot of running and other things, athletic, I played football. So I played football the 10th, 11th, and 12th grade in high school, where I was a defensive back and a wide receiver. Won 3 letters. Each year I won a letter. I also played basketball, and I was on the swimming team, and I was on the track team. And on the track team, I made All-City as a pole vaulter. I also ran the quarter mile to 220, broad jump, or at that time it was called the long jump. And once I ran the hurdles, as well as pole vaulting. Pole vaulting was my expertise. As a matter of fact, I made All-City twice, and I competed in the All-State meet. At the same time, I was still boxing. I boxed year-round. And as a matter of fact, while I was in high school, or up until I got to high school, I won the 1964 Novice Championships. In 1965, when I was a senior in high school, I ran for the office of president of the graduating class, and I became president. And I also went to Kansas City, Missouri, representing the city of Detroit in the Golden Gloves, and I won the National Golden Gloves Championship. In 1966, after I graduated from high school, I attended college, went to Eastern Michigan University, Detroit Institute of Technology, etc. And I won 66 and 67. I still continued to box. I went into the service in the summer of 1967. I was in the Army Security Agency, and I was stationed in Fort Devens, Massachusetts. And while I was stationed there in the fall of 1967, there was boxing gym there, so I began to do some boxing, practicing and sparring. And so since I was the only person there that could box, I began to teach other people how to box. And then we had a post-boxing championship, which I organized. And the winners of the post-boxing championship, I talked the post-commander into enrolling them, as well as myself, into the local Golden Gloves, which was the Lowell, Massachusetts. I won the Lowell, Massachusetts Golden Gloves, and as a result, I got a chance to compete the following week in the New England Golden Gloves, and I won that championship. Well, I came home for Christmas, my father died, and I got a discharge from the Army, and this was in Christmas of 1967, going into 1968. So I got out of the Army in February of 1968 and came back home. And I decided to get prepared for the Olympic Games. However, Detroit had already had their local Golden Gloves, so I had won the New England Championships, and I contacted the Boston Globe and asked them, since I had won their championship, could I represent them at the National Golden Gloves Championships in Salt Lake City, Utah? And so they sent me a uniform and everything else and a plane ticket, and I flew to Utah. Representing the state of New England, and I got all the way to the semifinals in the National Golden Gloves Championship. However, I was fighting as a light heavyweight, and my natural weight was a middleweight. But when I was in the Army, and when I won that post championships and in the Lowell Sun Championships and the New England Championships, I fought as a light heavyweight. Well, by this time, I had gotten into really good shape, and I was back to my normal weight, which was 160 pounds. But I was fighting at 178 pounds. So, fortunately, I didn't win the championships because I would have had to qualify in the Olympic Games as a light heavyweight. So, since I lost that, the only way I could qualify for the Olympic Games now was to win the National AAU Championships, because the Olympic Trials had to be either a national champion, Golden Gloves, AAU, a Army champ, Navy, Marines, Air Force, or you had to be one of the Olympic regional trials, and they had already had the one in the East, which was in New York, and they had already held the one in the West, which was in California. So I said, boy, the only way I can get in the Olympics trial finals is to win the National AAU Championships, and they were being held in Toledo, Ohio. I was living in Detroit. So once again, I wrote to the Boston Globe, and I asked them would they represent me, or could I represent them, and they said they would sponsor me. However, I had to pay my own way. So they sponsored me, and I went to Toledo, and I fought some very, very, very superior boxers. I was very fortunate, and I won the National AAU Championships. After the National AAU Championships, I was selected as a member of a team that included George Foreman and several other boxers who had great reputations to go to Germany for a four-bout tour. Where we could get some international competition, because they thought that the ones who were selected would be people who would win the Olympic trials, and so they needed international competition. So we went to a training camp outside of New York City in the Catskill Mountains. We trained there for about 3 weeks, and then we went to Germany. We had fights in West Berlin, Frankfurt, Stuttgart, and one other city that I can't think of at the moment. So the first fight that I had in Germany was against their Olympic champion. They had already held their Olympic trials, and I fought their Olympic champion, and I clearly decisioned him. There was no problem beating him. And then in my second fight, which I think was in Frankfurt, I beat their national champion. And then in the third fight, I beat their national champion runner-up. And then in the fourth fight that I had there, which was in, and I'm having trouble trying to think of the name of the city right off the top of my head, but in my fourth fight there, they had to find a local fighter. And the local fighter that they found knocked me out in 18 seconds of the first round. Unbelievable.
Wow.
But anyway, we came back to Detroit. I mean, we came back to the United States, and we got prepared for the Olympic trials. And Olympic trials, once again, was held in my favorite city, Toledo, Ohio, where I had won the National AAU Championships, and which was very close to my house, so I had a fan base. I won the Olympic trials, and in the final fight there, I fought probably one of the greatest amateur fights of all time. I fought a fighter from the U.S. Navy. His name was Al Bolden, and we put on a spectacular fight that was watched by thousands of people on the wide world of sports. I received about 50 telegrams the next day concerning my victory in the finals of the Olympic trials there. Anyway, after I won the Olympic trials, then we were sent to Santa Fe, New Mexico, to get high-altitude training for Mexico City. So we trained at a place called St. John's University in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And then we had to fight a second fight with the person that we beat in the finals. So we fought again in Arizona, at Arizona University of Arizona, and we fought again, and then I decisioned him, Al Bolden, again, and it wasn't as spectacular because he was afraid of me and I was afraid of him after after the great fight that we had in the Olympic trials. So now I'm officially the Olympic representative in the middleweight division. There were great there were write-ups about us in the various newspapers, including New York City and so on. And many sportscasters thought that this team that was selected was probably one of the weaker teams that was being sent to the Olympics. They didn't think we were great as a 64 Olympic team. And many of the fighters, even though we won, they thought that other fighters who lost or who didn't get a chance to get to the finals would have been better selectees.
Right.
However, we thought differently.
So up until this point in your personal life, did you have a family or anything at this point? Or
at this point, I was only 21.
Okay.
So I did not have a family. I was not married. I did have a girlfriend.
Okay.
And she and I had been dating since I was in high school.
Okay.
And she was attending college. And I was... I had a big family at home. My father had died, as I had indicated earlier.
Right.
And so my mother was, I had four sisters who were younger than me, who were at home. And back and forth from home to boxing, I was working various jobs.
Right.
And I was sending money home to my family. And I had one particular mentor who... was sending me money. He sent me approximately $100 a week while I was training, and I was gone for like maybe 2 months altogether. And so every week I received a Western Union money order from him for $100. His name was Isidore Chaikin, and he was a liquor store owner that I had worked for when I was a child. So he sent me this money, and then what I did was I just sent it to my mother, and she used it. $100 was big money back in 1968. People were only making $2.35, $2.55 cent an hour, so $100 was quite a lot of money.
Did I read that you had a nickname that you went by, or had you gotten that nickname yet?
Well, I hadn't gotten this nickname, but I turned professional as a professional boxer.
All right, then I won't ask you.
Tiger
that there.
Cat. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so go ahead.
Okay, but when we got to Mexico, certainly there was a, before we got to Mexico, I should say, you know, the teams were meeting in various locations in Denver, Colorado, and then the whole team, U.S. Olympic team, met in Dallas, Texas, and we were there for about 3 days assimilating, because there was not only the boxing team, the basketball team, the wrestling team, fencing team, swimming team, track team, and everyone was coming from different directions, so it took almost a week for everybody to get there so that we all could leave to Mexico as one team. So while we were there, there was a number of people who came to talk to us about whether or not the black athletes wanted to perform in the Olympics or whether or not we should boycott and not go.
Right.
So there were a number of speakers and so on. And we received a lot of literature. And so I went to a couple of the speaking engagements, myself and George Foreman. And we listened to people talk to us and so on and so forth. One of the people who came who just amazed me was Jackie Robinson. And Jackie Robinson talked just for a few minutes about our responsibility to, you know, ourselves and to our race and so on and so forth. And whatever we do, make sure we're true to ourselves and so on and so forth. And he told us about Lou Alcindor, who decided not to go, and I think a couple other people who decided not to go, Arthur Ashe maybe. But anyway, it was really up to us, but they were just giving us some information. Then there were some other groups who might have been sort of radical who wanted to speak to us as athletes as well. Many people didn't go. Okay.
Right.
And there were a couple of other people that talked to us. When we got to Mexico, one of the people that came to talk to us was Jesse Owens. And it just blew my mind, the fact that I was able to talk to two of the greatest black athletes of all time, in my opinion, Jackie Robinson and Jesse Owens. it was just an event that I just will always remember and cherish, just to, you know, to stand there and shake his hand and talk about things. But anyway, he came to speak to us about, once again, our duties and our responsibilities as Americans and so on and so forth. And so he was of the belief that we should perform, that we should do our best, and the best way to protest is to win.
Right.
So anyway, we got to Mexico City, and we had heard all this commotion about this organization there that, I don't know if you want to call them rebels or whatever, and several people had gotten killed. And as we were coming in, we heard shots and machine gun fire, and we saw newspaper articles with people who had been shot and were being hauled away, dead bodies hauled away in trucks and so on and so forth, and we were a little afraid. And then when we get to the Olympics, you know, we saw all the Mexican National Guardsmen who were guarding around the building, you know, not the building, I should say, but the fenced-in area and so on. And we wonder why we need soldiers. But anyway, they left after about 3 or 4 days, and things seemed to have calmed down. There was an organization that concerning in our involvement in the protest of Mexican democracy and so on and so forth. And I'm trying to think of the name of the group right off the top of my head. I'll come to it in a minute. But anyway, we had joined that group, and they gave us pins and so on and so forth for Olympic athletes for, I wish I could think of the name of it. It'll come to me shortly. But anyway, when we got to, from an athletic standpoint, probably the, we got this maybe a month before the Olympics started, 3.5 weeks or so before the Olympics started, so we got to get a chance to become accustomed to the altitude, the food, the water. And we stayed in Olympic Village, and we had an apartment, and we drew straws for who gets what room, and just fortunately, George and I, who had were roommates when we went to Germany, and we were roommates when we went to this training camp, and we won the national AAUs together, and we got to the Olympics, we got lucky to share a room together. So we got a bedroom, and the bedroom overlooked the promenade. Out in front of our building was this great area, meeting area, where people just met and talked and so on. And it was a great place to look out to every day. And behind us, back of the building, was where there was a recreational area, swimming pools, grass, refreshment area, and so on and so forth. So everyone had rooms. Some people slept in the kitchen, but it wasn't a kitchen, really. We made it into a bedroom. A living room was made into bedrooms and so on. We had a number of sports sports people who came in to talk to us. Howard Cosell came in to talk to us several times and to do reports and get our opinion about things and so on and so forth and get to know us and all that. We had an opportunity while we were training. We got up myself. Many times I went by myself, but I had two friends, Armando Muniz and David Vasquez, and I sort of speak a little Spanish. The area that I was raised in had a lot of Mexicans. The school that I was, the high school I graduated with from, was 30% Mexican, 30% black, and 30% white. And so, you know, there were many Mexican store owners, restaurants, and so on. So I spoke sort of, you know, spoken Spanish. And so David was Puerto Rican, and Armando was Mexican. And so we got a chance to, the three of us, go out a lot of places, and we visited Armando's uncle's family who lived in Mexico City. So we took a bus out to their house, and they knew we were coming, so they blocked off the whole city block, and they had a big fiesta for us. They had tables with food and music, guitar players, and the whole neighborhood was where it was like a big festival. I mean, one of their own was coming home to be in the Olympics and so on. So it was great. It was a great experience. So we went places every day. We would get up at 5 o'clock, and we'd do our running, and then we'd go watch the swimmers, and the swimmers would just swim back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. We just crazy about that. We'd go watch the weightlifters practice. We'd go watch the fencers. We just watched every sport that we could. We'd get on the bus and go to their venue and watch them practice, the track people and basketball players. And we just spent our whole time doing it and get back maybe 1 or 2 o'clock and for our afternoon training session. And then we'd eat and so on. And then we'd hop and go watch other people practice until the actual Olympics started. And I've been a lot of places, done a lot of things, but the opening ceremony where all the teams march in was probably the greatest event that I've ever taken part of or even seen in my whole life. I think the stadium held approximately 120,000 people in its pack. And when the American team marched in and I was on the 8th row and I was the second person to the left, I remember exactly where I was as we was marching in. And if I have the cover of the Olympic book that we have, volume, and it has the picture of the Olympic team marching in, and I can see myself on the 8th row, second from the left, and it's easy to see me, spot me. But walking in that stadium and the thunderous roar and looking around at the greatest athletes in the world all assembled in one place, and I was one of them. And that's the part that overwhelmed me, you know, and I almost broke down and cried because I'm where I came from and who I was. You know, I was a pretty bright person. I was pretty, you know, but here I was. This is in the world. Right. This is not on the block or in the city, you know, but this is in the world, you know, the fastest, the strongest, you know. It was just unbelievable being in that group. And so, you know, there was a bunch of people there on our team who I became friends with, and this was their second or even third Olympic Games. And when they opened up the, I forget what you call it, well, all the pigeons, doves, uh-huh, let loose maybe 1,000 birds, and they knew that they were going to do it. And so what they did was they took their coats off and put them over their heads, because as the doves flew overhead, they dumped on everybody.
That's funny.
Oh, man. And so if you got it in the face, this is the tradition, if you got it in the face, you're going to win a medal. And so I'm looking up at all these birds just flying over, not thinking about it, pop, 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 pop. And I got bird crap all over my face. And I'm going to win a medal. And I'm going to win 3 medals.
Did you know about that tradition before they released
it? No, I never knew it.
That's
funny. And the people didn't say anything to me because they all were prepared. And I said, why are these guys taking off their coats? Yeah. And they put their coats over their head as the birds flew over. Yeah. But anyway, I didn't think of doing it.
That was funny.
And I didn't know why they were doing it, but boom. I was one of the few people that got pumped all over the face with bird crap, you know, and you don't have anything to wipe it off with.
I'll have to pay attention to that the next time I watch the Olympics.
That'll be good. Yeah, they let them off. They let them go. Anyway, after that event, and I mean, I was just full of goosebumps the whole day. Yeah. And And then the next day, the competition started. And we had gathered around and became very close as a team, and we were determined to let the world know that we were the best there, and that even though our own sportscasters, announcers, looked up, frowned upon our abilities and so on, we ended up out of the 11 boxers that were sent to the Olympics. We came back with five bronze medals, two gold medals, and one silver medal. Okay, so no one had done that before.
Right.
The 60 team, the 64 team, no one had won that many medals, a total of two gold, a silver, and five bronze. And I was one of the ones that got a bronze. But we just, almost everybody just about went to the semifinals. You had to go to the semifinals to get a bronze.
Right.
I'm sorry. Excuse me. Anyway, my first fight was against against a fighter from South America, Peru, and it was a pretty tough fight because it was just a tough fight. The first fight is always because you're nervous and so tight, and our decision, I think it was 5-1 or something. And I was on my way. And I developed a rapport with the crowd because I was a fighter. I mean, I came to fight. And so when I was fighting this gentleman, I was all up in his face and so on. So, and the crowd loved that. Mexicans love fighters. In my division, the person who was selected to win, who was picked to win the middleweight division, was from Cuba. And the Mexicans were crazy about this guy. My second fight, I fought a guy from trying to think with him. I think it was a guy from Cuba.
Yeah, I think it was. I think it was a gentleman from Cuba.
My second fight.
Right.
And when I went in the ring first, they announced me, and they were Alfred Jones, Alfred Jones. But then when he came in, they went crazy. I mean, the crowd was, and I said, "Who is this guy, Pancho Villa?" I mean, they were just screaming and hollering. I said, "Oh boy." And so I was sort of like afraid, and so the coach said, "This is what you're going to have to do, Al. You're going to have to take it to him. I mean, like you've never done before. Before the bell rings, I want you to be heading to his corner. When the bell rings, I want you to have him. I want you to be right there. I want you to stay in his face the whole fight until he wilts." And so I stayed there, and I stayed there, and I stayed. This guy hit hard, but I stayed in his face. And then the second round, the third round, by the third round, he was just tired, and he was weak, and he was weary, and he wanted the referee to stop the fight, but the referee wouldn't. And so my hand was raised in victory, and the crowd was really quiet at first, until they realized what had happened, that I beat their hero, I beat the guy who's going to win the gold medal. And they just started hollering, "Alfred Jones, Alfred Jones, Alfred Jones, Alfred Jones." And wow, was I somebody. And that evening I went out, and people were asking for autographs and this and that. I mean, there was 20 people around me, and I said, "Boy, now my mama needs to see this."
Can I ask you about the Cuban team at this point? Where towards the end of the 60s and 70s, they developed into a pretty powerful boxing team. Were they the team to beat?
I was the last American to beat a Cuban in the middleweight division until the last Olympics. In the last Olympics, there was an American that beat a Cuban, and it was the first time that an American had beat a Cuban in a middleweight division since 1960.
Yeah, I knew they were pretty dominant in that.
They were dominant. And, they had that heavyweight, Teofilo Stevenson, who won three straight Olympic Games as the heavyweight.
Right. Was that you guys, going into the Olympics, was that who you guys looked at as the people to beat then? Were the Cuban team members?
Honestly, no.
No, okay.
In our mind, the majority of the team, we had three guys who had plenty of international experience and well over 100 fights. Ronnie Harris had over 125 fights. He had probably 20 or 30 fights in Europe. He had fought in the He had fought in Germany before. He had fought Spain. He had been to numerous foreign countries, so he had a great deal of experience. And then there was another person on the team, and his name escapes me right now, but he was in the Army, and he had had a lot of exposure and experience to international competition. But they were the only two. All the rest of us were new guys to this thing. Okay. And so we didn't really care about Cubans. We didn't care about who? Russians. Russians. What is that, a salad dressing? You know, we weren't overwhelmed by that. So it didn't bother us to say, well, you know, guess what? We got to fight the Cubans. Well, you know, they put their shoes on just like we do. So it never did bother us. Yeah.
Did you guys?
We fought, if I remember correctly, four. I beat one. Ronnie Harris beat one, a Cuban, in the finals. Johnny Baldwin, I think, lost to a Cuban in the semifinals. And he and Johnny Baldwin got a bronze because he lost to a Cuban. And I think our first loss was the light heavyweight, Arthur Redden. I think he lost to a Cuban. So other than that, you know, we fought five times against Cubans and won three, I think.
Right. Did you guys get a chance to meet very many of the competitors in boxing?
Oh, yeah. See, we had this huge gym, and so the gym had maybe five rings, boxing rings, and each ring had curtains around it, so competitors couldn't watch each other compete. We didn't care. We wanted people to see what we were doing, you know, so we kept the curtains open and so on and so forth. And everyone, all the other athletes, all the other boxers from other teams were just amazed because we were the Americans. And we played music and we danced and we, you know, we just having a ball. Whereas they were sort of Greco-Romanist, you know, they were strictly, right, you know, work, hard work ethic and so on. And they weren't really enjoying themselves like we were, so they would always be watching us and so on. So after we got through training, we would see them in the cafeteria. We'd see them, out relaxing and so on, and they'd come over and we'd talk and so on and so forth, because many spoke English. Many did not, but many did speak English. So as a matter of fact, the Russians in particular, you know, they had people that told them not to talk to us.
Right.
And so they ignored us and so on and so forth. But when we went for walks out into Mexico City and we were going and watching the other teams practice and we would run into them, you know, in town or something, they would talk and, hey, and they wave and all this kind of stuff. And they run over and they share whatever they were eating, popcorn, candy or whatever. And we didn't, like, become friends, but we did introduce ourselves and tried to talk and so on and so forth. But as long as they weren't with their, you know, their people, because they had spies and so on who were walking around, and you know they could get sent home, you know, just for talking to us.
Did you get to interact at all with the Soviet bloc country athletes at all?
Oh, that's what I speak. Oh, you mean as far as Romania, Bulgaria, and so on and so
Soviet
forth.
Union.
I fought a gentleman from Bulgaria, we didn't get a chance to really interact after I beat him, you know, and so on and so forth. You know, we talked in the locker room and so on. But, you know, as you're walking around, you really don't know who's who.
Right.
And so you might be waving at a guy and becoming friends, and you find out you got to fight him tomorrow. You didn't even know he was a boxer. You thought he was a track star, you know.
Right.
So, and it's so many. Say, for example, in my middleweight division, there were like 48 or 50 fighters.
Uh-huh.
And they were from Africa, they were from India, you know, 50 different countries. And so you didn't know who was who. You didn't know if they were middleweight or junior middleweight.
Right.
Or that they were a boxer at all. Because, you know, people walk around with their jogging suits on, and so you didn't know who was who. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or what sports they participated in.
Okay, so how did it end for you? You got through the Cuban, okay, and then
I got through him, and then I fought a guy from Bulgaria, and then I fought a guy from England. I had four fights, and Christopher Finnegan, and it was probably one of the fights that they showed over and over and over. The commentator, I have it on tape. I got it from Wide World of Sports about 25 years later after the fight. But Howard Cosell is the commentator, and I won the first round and the third round unanimous. I mean, there was just no doubt that I won those two rounds. But they gave the fight to him. and the crowd went ballistic. They started screaming and hollering. They started throwing pesos and tomatoes, and they held up the next fight for about a half hour because they were just so upset of them robbing me of the fight.
Right.
And so Howard Cosell commented on how, you know, some of the decisions that were arrived at go beyond, you know, go beyond fairness, and it has to do with politics.
Right. Do you remember? Do you remember any of the judges, where they were from, or anything? Speaking of politics, not anything.
I did at that time, but I don't remember now. I know they were from like Turkey. One was from Turkey. I know one from Mexico. But you know,
was that something that the team itself had to be conscious of? Because I know as Olympics have gone along, there have been a lot of controversial decisions and people have attested.
At that time, there were several controversial decisions. We were involved in two, mine and the light heavyweight that I was telling you about earlier, who lost to the Cuban.
Uh-huh.
And I think he won that fight. And many people also think he won the fight. And couldn't go either way. It wasn't that tight. It wasn't that close. He won the fight. But anyway, mine was more so unanimous because I knocked the guy down twice.
Wow.
You know, they were called standing knockdowns. If you have a person in the corner and you are landing several hard blows, the referee would jump between the two of you and start counting and give him a standing eight count. And that's the same thing as a knockdown.
Right. Okay.
So that happened twice in the fight. And they're considered knockdowns. And he still won the fight. So happened in the first round, it happened in the third round. So anyway, I was sorely disappointed. But you know what? I'm a very competitive person, but I did something that I never thought I could do. I mean, I went all the way to the semifinals in the Olympic Games. You know, I was a member of the Olympic team. You know, and certainly I didn't get a gold, I got a bronze. But just to be there, you know, just to be there. I mean, I don't know anybody. I never met anybody who was in the Olympics.
Right.
Now when I got back and so on, I met several people from Detroit who had been in the Olympics in '60. And several others that were in the Olympics in '64, and because you know there became a brotherhood, you know, where they were asking former Olympians to give speeches and work in schools and do other types of things, and I began to meet other Olympians. But until that point, I never knew anybody that was an Olympian, and none of my friends knew any Olympians.
And they can't take that away from you once you've done.
No.
So that's really
good. So.
Did the decision leave a bad taste in your mouth at that time, or did you get over it fairly quickly? Or?
No, didn't leave a bad taste in my mouth.
That's good.
You know, it was done. You know, I gave it my best shot.
Yeah.
They gave the fight to someone else, and that was it. I really attribute it to, I think, one thing. The fight before the semifinals when I fought the Romanian, he hit me on the chin and split it. And so it split the chin just a little bit. Well, we had to spray some stuff on it called Nu Skin because you have to pass a physical every time you fight. And so we put this coloration stuff on it so the doctors couldn't see that I had a cut there. Now, if they had to put stitches, I couldn't have fought at all. But they put this stuff on it. Anyway, I passed the physical. Now, the first punch that the guy from Great Britain, Christopher Fennekin, who later on became the British Commonwealth and the European light heavyweight champion and fought twice for the World Light Heavyweight Championship. But anyway, the first real solid punch that he hit me with split it. Okay. And it continued to get wider and wider as the fight went on. Now, I didn't draw a lot of blood, but after the fight, I had to have six stitches put in my cheek. So if I had won the fight, then the next night, the finals, I wouldn't have been able to fight.
Right.
And so I would have been disqualified. And if you're disqualified, you don't get a medal.
Oh, yeah.
You have to compete to get a medal. So I would have been able to stand on the stand, and I would have came in second place, but I would not have received a medal. And so sometimes I think that maybe the judges thought about that, you know, and said, said, you know what, this guy put up a good fight. You know, he's had three or four good fights. Maybe if we give it to him, he's not going to be able to fight the next night. So I'm just thinking, you know, what made them give the fight to someone else when I...
Right.
But I thought about that because they rushed me straight to the locker room and the guy stitched me up. They didn't even have any know we came. He gave me a shot of tequila. He drank this. I said, what is this? Just drink it. I'm Mexican again.
Right.
So he got it on a needle and thread and just started stitching up my cheekbone. And that was that. So the next day I was being interviewed because that was the same night that Carlos and Smith.
Right.
Tommy Smith and John Carlos had gotten on the stands and took their shoes off and raised their black gloves. And so when they did that, people had seen me, reporters and so on, seen me several times with John Carlos, and I became friends. And as a matter of fact, we had traded our American uniforms for African uniforms. I traded mine from a guy from Trinidad Tobago because they had these colorful uniforms.
Right.
And he traded his from a guy from Africa. And I don't know if it was Nigeria, but it was a real colorful dashiki and so on and so forth. But we traded our uniforms because we had several anyway, so it didn't really matter. But we talked a lot. You know, because he was much older than me, and he'd already graduated from college, you know, and so he was married, and he was staying at a hotel, and I always wanted to know where he might stay at a hotel, but anyway, so I've been seen with him several times, and so a lot of reporters, including Howard Gosell, approached me to give my comments on what I thought about what they did and so on and so forth. And so it was aired on TV, and my mother saw me, but I got this big patch on my face from the stitches. And she saw it, and she started crying, look at my baby,
That's funny.
She didn't know, everybody saw the fight, because, you know, that night I got telegrams the next day from everybody, you know, Japan and Germany, of people who saw the fight and said I was robbed, you know.
Right.
And people who saw me fight in Germany when I was on that tour there, those four cities, you know, they certainly sent me telegrams because I'd beat their Olympic champ. But anyway, they sent me telegrams, and so I saved many of them.
Had Carlos mentioned anything about trying to protest or anything like that? Did he talk to you about his feelings about all that?
Say that again, I'm sorry.
Had Carlos talked to you about...
After they raised their fists and so on, they were rushed out of there. I mean, they went, you know, people were all around and had them surrounded, and they went and changed clothes and went to their hotel. And then it came out from the president of the International Olympic Committee that if they weren't kicked off of the team, that America had to forfeit all of its medals. And they went to the hotel where they were and told them that they were disqualified and so on and so forth. And they were really upset, okay, because it had nothing to do with the competition. They came in first and third. How you take away our medals and this and that? And so the press was really pressing them. They weren't the media. They were the press because they were really pressing them. And they had to use, they were all in his wife's face, you know, and she had a hard time, Carlos' wife, over this, you know. I think you know that later on she ended up committing suicide. You know?
No, I didn't know that. I wasn't aware of that.
Yes. The stress and the letters they received and all that, you know, so on and so forth. She never did. The depression that it put her into. So, and she was young. She was only like 23, and he was like 25 or 20. Yeah, about 25.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we never got a chance to talk again.
Years and years later,
you know.
Since you brought up the media, and you said you hung out with Howard Cosell quite a bit from interviewing, what was your impression of the media down there and the coverage? Any experiences with that?
You know what? Not really.
No.
I mean, you had certain people from the press, and we didn't know very many of them. Everybody knew Howard Cosell because he covered boxing, and he covered Muhammad Ali. And so, remember, this is only 68, and at that time, Muhammad Ali still was, banned from boxing, if you remember.
Right.
And he got banned, I think it was in 67, and he was pardoned in 69 or 70. So it was 3 years that he was not into boxing. But Howard Cosell was really one of the few people I knew. Now, the press was all over the place, and then when I say all over the place, they were doing interviews and so on, and they had certain times they could do it because they were very, you know, they could be bothersome. And we had freedom of movement, and we'd be sitting around the pool because we had an Olympic-sized swimming pool that we could just sit by on these hammocks and stuff, and they had servers that was bringing us cookies and refreshments and drinks, and it was like, you know, the Taj Mahal. We were having it made. Yeah. Then we'd go inside, and they had all this food, anything you wanted, you know. And so they had certain times where the press could come in and talk. And it was like maybe an hour here and 45 minutes there, whatever the case may be. And then they had to leave because we needed our freedom.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't know anybody personally other than Howard Cosell. You know, and there's a number of people there that I knew by name, but, you know, like you see them doing Keith Jackson, for example. You know,
right.
The commentator who just Schenkel, who was just passed away at 88 or 89 years old. Chris Schenkel,
yeah.
He was the commentator, and a couple other people like that. You see them, you wave and so on. They smile and so on and so forth. But, yeah.
So it didn't become a distraction for you guys at all?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This Olympics was known also for the fact that drug testing and gender testing started. Do you remember any of that being tested,
not
anything like
least
that?
Bit. Not in the least bit. I never knew anything about it. We did hear about someone being kicked off of the team and sent home, but I think it was an Eastern European person. But other than that, because we just weren't in, we didn't know anything about enhancement type drugs and so on.
You guys don't remember being tested then at all?
No, we never were tested.
Yeah. Okay.
No. I don't remember any athlete, whether it was basketball, track, or anything, being tested for, you know, performance enhancing drugs.
Yeah, I've heard that from other athletes that I've talked to. They said the same thing. Some of them only remember the gender testing, the females I've talked to.
Right. But that was sort of, what's the word I want to use, stereotypical.
Right. So did you get around much? You said you were going to other events. When you were finished with yours, did you get to see any of the record-setting events, or did you get?
Well, you know what? I was at the track when Beeman jumped 29 feet. You know, and we weren't really at the track, but there's a little area where you're inside of the stadium, like in an enclosed area where there are TVs. And it was raining, and I remember we were all standing there, and we were watching on a TV monitor, even though he was out on the track live, but we couldn't see him live because he was way on the other side of the track. But we could see it on the TV monitor. And so we saw that event. We did see, I did anyway, Judy Meyer, the 15-year-old swimmer.
Uh-huh.
She won 5 gold medals. And I was always waiting for, what's his name, the male swimmer, who was also 16, to break out because they said he was going to win 7 gold medals.
Was that Spitz at that time, Mark Spitz?
Mark Spitz.
Yeah.
And I got to be good friends with him because I was watching him practice at the swimming pool. Of course, he was only 17, you know, and I think there was just too much stress and pressure on him because I think he ended up winning a bronze and a silver instead of 5 gold. But he came back the next Olympics, as you know, and won 6 gold medals and set 6 world records.
Right.
I got to know him. I got to know some wrestlers, Greco-Roman wrestlers. I got to know some weightlifters. I got to know a lot of people. You know, when I say no, I got to meet them and sit down and eat with them at the dinner table, you know, and talk sports and what they went through. And they were amazed at the things that we did, and I was amazed at the things that they did, you know, as far as running and lifting weights and things that we had to do as boxers, you know.
Right.
And, anyway.
So, obviously in America at that time, there were a lot of racial tensions and stuff. You didn't feel that as far as being a competitor with your teammates and stuff? Everybody was getting along well? Or?
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, it was not a real... I I don't know if the racism that we experienced in the 60s, a great deal of it was institutional racism and political racism, you know, but from an individual standpoint, you know, like I had, like I said, I told you about where I went to school and
right.
so on and so forth. Now, we had riots here. I mean, we had riots in 1967 that began July the 9th and lasted until the 26th or something, where they had a curfew. And it was a riot, and it really started out as a riot against institutions, you know. Quick example, there was a post office here, a main post office that had 1,100 employees per shift, and all the blacks were inside mail sorters. None of them were mail delivery persons or truck drivers. They were all, like, inside of this plantation. None of them were supervisors, okay? They made up 98% of the employees, but they didn't make up any of the management staff or supervision, okay? Chrysler Corporation, which was the largest employer in the city of Detroit, had 17 automobile factories inside of the city of Detroit, and they had certain plants that had 3,000 employees, over 500 foremen, and they may have had, at most, 2 black foremen.
Right.
And so that was what they were rebelling against, you know, police officers. You know, you had a 5,000-man police force, and you had maybe, you know, 100 blacks, but none of those blacks were sergeants or detectives. Yeah. And so the riots were really against, we're just tired of being, you know, stepped on. They can't rise up above. They say, you ought to be happy. Well, I don't want to be happy as a, you know, I want to be able to rise up above just like anyone else and so on and so forth.
So it was the opportunity you were looking for.
I'm sorry?
You were looking for the opportunity, the same opportunities.
Sure, that's it. And that's why I was going to college at the time. Now, what happened was, after the Olympics, I turned professional, had several fights. As a matter of fact, I won 14 straight fights, 15 straight fights, and I was the Fighter of the Month for Ring Magazine.
Uh-huh.
And I had a big fight on the Joe Frazier, Bob Foster heavyweight championship fight that they had in Detroit, and I made about $15,000 on that fight. And so I saved up my money, and I opened up a liquor store. Okay.
Yeah.
I did pretty well at that. And then, you know, I had one more fight, and then I quit. I was working at Chrysler, as a matter of fact. And got a decent job there as the manager.
Right.
Anyway, and I went back to school, and I got an associate's, a bachelor's, a master's degree, and completed all my coursework towards a PhD. And after I sold the liquor store after 15 years, I went back to work at Chrysler, and I've been working for them since 1987 or so. And I teach at several schools right now. Most of my time is with the University of Phoenix.
Right.
I've been with them for 14 years, teaching part-time and working with Chrysler. I develop training programs for employees, workplace diversity, conflict resolution, sexual harassment, workplace violence prevention, new hire orientation, those types of things. I've been doing that for quite a while.
This is meant as a compliment, but that's almost as impressive as your Olympic accomplishment, that you went so far and did so many things after the Olympic career. One of my questions was going to be, you went 14, 15 straight fights, and then you lost one and then stopped. What was it that prompted you to stop?
You remember the movie Forrest Gump, and Forrest Gump started running one day, just felt like running.
Yeah.
And he just ran and ran and ran and ran, and then he was halfway through the desert or somewhere, and everybody saw him. He just stopped.
Right.
He said, you know what, I don't want to run anymore.
Yeah, I understand.
Well, I was like 22, maybe 23, And I've been boxing, remember, since I was 14. So it's only like 10 years, maybe 11 years.
Right.
But see, I put everything into it. I mean, when I trained, I trained. And I remember I went one time a full year without missing a day in a gym. 365 days. I mean, I went to the gym on birthdays, every Sunday, Christmas Day I was at the gym, New Year's Day I was at the gym, you know. I just went, you know, to the gym. I lost one of my sisters, you know, and before the funeral, I went to the gym, you know.
Right.
I went to the gym every day, you know. When I first started, you know, the trainer told me you can't eat, drink pop and eat candy. I had perfect teeth because I stopped eating pop and candy at 14, you know.
Right.
I never drank, you know, alcohol, you know, and I never smoked cigarettes. And so, you know, I wanted to do some things.
Right, I understand.
So guess what I did? I quit boxing and I went and bought a pack of cigarettes and went out with some buddies and drank some whiskey.
That's
yeah.
funny.
Yeah, even though I own a, you know, and so later on I owned the liquor store, like I said. But you know what? I was through. You know, I still had a bright future. My trainer, at the time, really, he just passed away, 99 years old. Yeah, he tried his best. He said, "Al, man, you got a career. You can make some money. You know, please don't quit. Don't go out a loser." Well, I didn't consider myself going out a loser. My last amateur fight I lost, you know, in the Olympics. So, you know, it never bothered me.
Right.
You know. You know. So, I lost this fight, you know. Got knocked out.
Right.
See, and I took a good punch. And so the referees that I've had know that Al Jones might bleed all over the place, but don't stop the fight. He's all right. Ain't nothing wrong with him. And so the guy knocked me down in the second round. They knocked me down again in the fourth round. But I was still putting up a fight. But guess what? I was out. I don't remember anything from the fourth round all the way through the ninth round. The referee stopped the fight in the ninth round. And I don't remember anything after the fourth round. And I thought, you know what, I think it's time for me. I mean, if this happened, this guy wasn't really a heck of a puncher, you know, but he caught me cleanly several times, you know, and dropped me. And so the referee let it go on and on and on. Everybody was telling me, stop the fight, you know. And I said, "Oh, Joe, you don't stop no fight, you know.
Right.
I was going to knock this guy out in a minute." So
let's go back to the finishing up the Olympics real quick.
Sure.
Your best memories of the Olympics. I know we still have to talk about like the closing ceremonies and you
sure.
know what are your reflections back on that?
Well, you know, the closing ceremonies, I wasn't prepared for it. You know, we were told that we had to stay in the stands and that they would have one athlete carry the flag and two people with him. That was it. And we were really, really upset about that. And when the American flag came around out of the, when it came out onto the field, we all just jumped over the barriers and just ran on, got behind the flag. And so it was hundreds of us. And so after we did it, all the other teams started doing it, you know. And then when the English flag came out, everybody jumped behind it and so on and so forth. And so people were running all out on the field, you know, getting behind their flags. And they weren't causing a commotion or a distraction. They were just showing their nationhood, you know, nationhood. And I certainly was following, jumped out there with mine. And we just ran out on the field. And they had, if I remember correctly, about 125 guitar players.
Oh, flamenco.
They're out on the field playing. But anyway, when all the teams got out on the field, they dimmed the lights. Phew. And it became very emotional. And they had some men who were like soldiers who had on white gloves and so on, and they were marching out carrying an Olympic flag, and what they did was they lowered the Olympic flag real slowly and folded it up and like put it in like a casket because it's dead, it's over with, and then they raised the new flag, if I remember correctly, and all the explosions and fireworks and everything, and all the lights came on, because it was really sad and solemn, you know, watching our Olympic flag go down. You know, this 10-day period is over with, all the work that we experienced and trained all these years for, and it's now getting ready to end. And so it was like a funeral. And all of a sudden, the explosions and the fireworks, and everybody ran out, spectators came out on the field, and everybody was hugging and kissing and holding hands. And I met a lady from Canada, and she had won a bronze medal when swimming. And so we ran out on the field, we were running, we were holding hands, and I just met her. And so we introduced ourselves, and let's go here. And we were just all over the place, and so it lasted late, you know. And so we ended up going downtown, and it was thousands of athletes, and, you know, people just congregating throughout the whole city, and it was just like something, you know, that you would see in a movie or something. You know, it was just exciting.
Right.
But it wasn't like the opening ceremony, but it was exciting. event. So those two, you know, embellish my memory and will be, you know, forever. I wish I could see it on film.
Right. So looking back over the Olympics, what are some of those things that really stand out to you? It sounds like the ceremonies are pretty high on your list.
The ceremonies were really high, but I think what really, the money that went into the practice facilities and the availability for the athletes to go watch the other athletes practice, it's just phenomenal. Watching other athletes practice in their bailiwick, you know, in their environment, which is just breathtaking. Like I said, I really love the swimmers because they just jump in the water and they just start going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, like maybe an hour without stopping. And then the coaches show up. He says, "All right, you guys ready to work?"
Yeah.
Ready to work. That guy just swam 6 miles, you know. All right, we're going to start out with some speed drills. You know, whoa, I left. Speed drills. Yeah. Then we go watch the basketball players. They're running back and forth and running back and forth and to and fro. I mean, you know, just seeing these great people. You know, just and then, you know, I was watching the African marathon runners. You know, they had a great Egyptian and Nigerian and so on and so forth, and watching them just jog. You know, wow, they were just so smooth. You know, Abibi Bikini, I can't even say his name, who won the marathon without any shoes on.
Right.
Yeah. But I think that was it. And then being able to sit down and talk with the athletes, you know, many people who could speak English, and even your own, you know, countrymen. I mean, Bruce Jenner, people, you know, on the team, you know, the girls from the track team. Yeah. The track team was made up of about 35-40% of the track team was made up of athletes from Tennessee State. I think they had 7 runners on the team from Tennessee State.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And all of them won a gold medal, seemed like. You know, they won in the relay, they were in the high jump, or they were in Wyomia Tyson. I think she won the 100. And Madeline Manning won the 400. They just were tough. And so just going around and eating and sitting down and eating with these people and sharing stories and so on and so forth. And you find out how much each of you had so much in common, you know, with each other. You know, and I felt a little bad because, you know, like I said, I was 22. I turned 22 when we were in Dallas, either Dallas or Denver. And I turned 22. And the girls, I knew many girls on the track team, so they threw me a little party. Wasn't much, you know. They invited me up to their room, and surprise! You know. And so I was in a room with 5 women, and we danced, and then they put me out. Yeah. Can't have no cookie. We got a winning medal.
Right.
But the thing about it was, I was 22, and most of the people that were 22 were seniors in college. Yeah, and most of the track guys and distance runners and all those guys were 26 or whatever, and they had their bachelor's degrees, some, you know, master's degrees and so on and so forth, you know. And here, you know, I had a year of college or something, you know. And that sort of, you know, and they were using, they were very articulate, you know, they had these grandiose ideas about, you know, world politics and so on and so forth. And I never looked at it from a worldly point of view because I was probably localized, you know.
Right. So it sounds like the Olympics had a big impact, or did it have a big impact on your life throughout your life?
It had an impact greater than maybe one other thing in my life, you know, and that is having a personal relationship with the Lord, and two, being married. I mean, when I married my wife, it was the greatest event of my life, you know.
Uh-huh.
We were married 30, she deceased, she had cancer and died, but
sorry to hear that.
31 years, and it was 31 wonderful years, and so that those two things made me who I am.
Right.
Take those two events out of my life, I don't know what and where I would have ended up. Fate, whatever. And it was like it was supposed to happen. I was supposed to be on the Olympic team. I mean, the way things happened in the Army and everything, you know, how did I get to win the Lowell's Snow, that winning the Lowell's Sun, Golden Gloves,
right,
was going to end up with me winning a bronze medal in the Olympic Games. Yeah, I mean, one led to another, led to another, led to another. And then there was a lot of people who were supportive who, for example, the Boston Globe didn't have to send me a ticket, you know, a plane ticket from Detroit to Salt Lake City, Utah, plus hotel fare to represent, you know, New England in the National Golden Gloves Championship. You know, what are they going to get out of it?
Right.
Okay. But I talked to some people, they were just, sure, blah, 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 blah. You know, we'll take care of you. They never knew me, you know, they never see me again. Yeah.
In your opinion, did it have much of, do you think the 68 games had much of an effect on world matters?
Oh, without a doubt.
Okay.
Without a doubt. It was set right in the middle of world affairs. You know, it brought people together, even though the event with Tommy and John Carlos may have polarized people, but it made people really see the reality of what's happening in the world. I mean, it was like, this ain't real. I mean, we had lost Martin Luther King, you know, he had been killed and so on and so forth. We had the Democratic convention going on in Chicago with all the fighting and beating up and the riots all throughout the country and so on. And yet, through all of that, we were able to come together as America's team. And people stopped for a minute to watch us compete. Yeah. And then when George Foreman walked around the ring with his American flag, which was to say that, you know what, there's two sides to every story. Number one, and we're still who we are, okay? And I'm no different than John Carlos and Tommy Smith.
Mm-hmm.
They love America. They're waving the glove, and I'm waving the flag, okay? And that's what's good about America. And, you know, and people just, it just changed my outlook on the whole world. And many people who saw, especially the athletes, yeah. So, yes, it did have a great impact on world events. Yeah, and it does every 4 years, even though it only lasts 10 days, 12 days. It does. It affects what people have to stop. You got to see this.
Right. If there was somebody that wanted to be an Olympian today, what kind of advice would you give them from your experiences?
You got to give it all. You got to give it all. And let me say this about what I mean by you got to give it all. It's not always who is the fastest or the strongest or the best who wins. It's the fastest and the strongest at that moment. You and I might compete against each other 10 times. You beat me 9 times. But in the Olympics is where it counts, okay? Mm-hmm. And so you have to be prepared right there, okay? You got to be at your best right then. Doesn't matter what the world record that you broke last week, it's right now. And that's why Olympic records only count in the Olympics. You might set the world record last week, but you got to break the Olympic record at the Olympics. And so what I'm saying is that you have to do it all. You have to. This is not like anything else. You know, where you can skip practice and you can skip homework. Nope. Don't work that way. You have to give it all. The sacrifice is way more than the average person is willing to do. Okay, because you're talking about being the best in the world at a particular moment. When the whistle goes off,
right?
Gun is shot. When the bell rings, you have to be the best in the world right then. You can't, oh, my stomach hurts. Oh, my corn. Oh, I shouldn't have did this. Oh, nope.
Well, I'm going to...
That's what I would tell them.
Sure. I'm going to give you the last say on anything. If there was anything else you wanted to add or any questions for us, I'm going to let you have final say.
It's a lifelong experience. I still relive the experience daily. It's been 45 years. What was it? 1968, 70, 30, 40. We just celebrated our 40th anniversary in 2008. We had a reunion in St. Louis. I think Tom Lowe may have talked to you about that.
Yeah, I think I've heard about that. Yeah, I did read.
Yeah, we had a reunion, and there was maybe 50 of who were able to come who weren't, who were physically able. And so a lot of people were just in. We're not able to physically because of their knees and hip operations and so on and so forth. So the average age, I guess, of the people who were there was about 69 or 68 or something like that. But anyway, the Olympics stayed in your life. Once an Olympian, you're always an Olympian. You're not an ex-Olympian or former Olympian. You're an Olympian. And so I still have my medal. I still have my ring. My ring. I got an Olympic ring. You know, got an Olympic medal. Got a chance to run the relay, the torch relay, when they had the Olympics there in Atlanta in 1996. And I got a chance to purchase their torch. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's with you all life. Here it is 40 years later, the Detroit Tigers asked me to throw out the opening pitch at a ball game during Olympic Day. You know, I'm asked to go to schools and speak about the Olympics. So I have videos of me boxing 40 years ago, and I showed it to the kids, and I talk about your sportsmanship and dedication and so on. And it stays with you. And people will always remember you. I've had kids who were 9 and 10 years old, and I talked to them at their school about the Olympics, and here they're 35 years old. Hey, there goes this John Miller. Man, I remember you came to my school when I was 9. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So it stays with you your whole life. I mean, they don't remember you got a college degree. They don't remember you retired from Forest. They don't remember that you used to live on, you know, certain street. They remember that you were an Olympian.
Right.
You're the only Olympian I ever met. You're the man.
Yeah.
You know, I went places, and, you know, they introduced Tommy Hearns. You heard of Tommy Hearns?
Yes.
Tommy Hearns won seven world championship, multi-man, some of the greatest fights with Sugar Ray Leonard and all this shit. So they introduced Tommy Hearns, and so, you know. And we also have the 1968 Olympian Al Jones. I mean, they forgot.
Yeah.
You know, you're an Olympian, you know. I mean, he's the five-time world champion, fought the best, you know. And so on. People bet money on him, and, you know, he's just part of people's lives, but an Olympian. Al Jones, the Olympian. Yeah, we remember him.
Yeah, they it always seems to have a special place in people's hearts and memories. Yeah.
Yeah, so I took my son, or he took me to some boxing matches about 8 or 10 months ago, and we're sitting next to this guy, and he looks about 10 years older than me. I'm 65, so he looked to be about maybe 70, 73, or somewhere like that. And he had two boys with him, and they were like in their 40s. He kept looking at me and kept looking at me, and finally he says, "You know, you're Al Jones, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "I used to watch you box. You're the Olympian." He said, "Fellas, I want you guys to meet Al Jones. He was a professional boxer and an Olympian." Dang! You know, an Olympian.
That's cool. Can I ask you one more last question? It's a little bit off topic. Boxing doesn't seem to be as popular these days as it was back in, you know, the 60s and 70s. What do you think that's attributed to? Is there any theory you've got about that? Like when the Olympics come around nowadays, they don't seem to televise the boxing as much. I mean, I remember growing up, boxing was like the headline sport for the Olympics almost. So
yeah.
What's your opinion
on
that?
There are a number of things. Other sports have just superseded the what people want to do. They've become more popular on and students for kids 14, 15 would rather do those things. The football players have just superseded everything. Michael Jordan, basketball, and so on. But the boxing is sort of an individualized type of thing. It's an individual sport. You have to get out there on your own and jog and run and punch bags and do all those other things. It's you and your coach and you and your sparring partner. It's not a group of people around watching you, you know, spectators while you're training and getting prepared. It's you. And so many times people just don't want to go through that. And so, and it requires a great deal of training. Yeah, I mean, I think more so than any other, you know, sports. And two, there are very few boxing gyms anymore. Three, there's very few coaches who would run those boxing gyms. And for one thing, so many other sports, especially this mixed martial arts, which is more violent. People have really want to see violence. And so that's a lot of blood and gore, and you don't see as much blood and gore like you used to in boxing, so they'd rather watch that. Yeah, all these computer games, you know, with this mixed martial arts, and all about violence and so on. You know, and we've become very violent in society. You know, even football with all the concussions and so on, violence in it, you know, and so on. So that may have something to do with it, but they're just not that interested.
Right. Well, I appreciate
that. Like I said, other sports have taken it away.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I was just curious, and since you're a boxer, I was just curious what your opinion was on that. We are all finished.
Okay.
So I'm.